Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 110, Be Mine, Sunday, February 14th, 2016. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. Today's episode includes the following segments: The Back Porch, The Front Porch, Ever-Expanding Skill Set, and Off the Shelf. I'd like to give a special welcome to some folks who have been in contact with me recently: Barb Sato from Walnut, California, and Sunny Day Knits, who is Vicky from Dripping Springs, Texas. Both of you have sent very sweet notes and personal messages on Ravelry. And thank you also for several new iTunes ratings, very favorable ones, and some lovely reviews from Mrs. Pivek and from Elise Dear. That is so sweet. Thank you very much. I hope that you're having a sweet and enjoyable weekend wherever you are. It has turned decidedly frosty here in the Delaware Water Gap, with temperatures hovering around 1 or 2 degrees Fahrenheit with wind chill factors that are well below zero. So we're finally experiencing a deep freeze, and maybe with some weather also coming this weekend. Before I begin with the regular segments, I just want to provide a bit of an update regarding technology. It is my practice each time I have a new episode to make a new podcast post on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. I use WordPress to fashion the elements of my blog post and insert a media file. There's also a widget with a Ravelry update, and I try to include links and photographs and things like that. The laptop that I'm using to record my podcasts and do my work online is a bit outdated, and it took me a while to realize that photographs that I was posting and which looked fine on my computer screen actually were coming out sideways and upside down on the iPhone and the iPad and with updated computers. And it was so embarrassing, because whenever I see someone post something and their photograph is sideways, I always feel a little bit sorry for them, like, oh, poor dear, doesn't know how to post a photograph. And then I started looking at my website on Samuel's new computer. Oh my gosh, it was like a total tragedy. Things were scrambled upside down. And possibly the worst thing was that due to some update that my computer hasn't caught up on, the media player for my episodes was not visible. And this wiped out the media player in all of my episodes. I suspect that most listeners use iTunes to listen to the Yarns at Yin Hu podcast. However, I know there are some people who go online and just play the media player from their device. I will not be going back to fix all previous episodes, but I think I have figured out a workaround so that the most recent and certainly upcoming episodes will have a visible media player. I have also provided a link to the iTunes website where you can listen for free Some folks are under the impression that iTunes podcasts have a fee. That's not true. You can listen to Yarns at Yinhu podcast for free by following the link that I provide. And I'm also trying to be a bit more cognizant of how photographs are oriented so that I don't have sad sideways photographs. So I've made some attempts in this episode. And once again, you can catch all of that on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. The back porch. I have completed an embroidered design on the front of my multitasker tote. This is a pattern from Anna Maria Horner that I made a few months ago. It's a fantastic pattern for a very roomy and useful tote bag, and it is ideal for scraps of fabric and small bits of fabric. So I was very pleased with this tote when I made it, and had an idea that I would embroider a design on the front of it. So I left a very wide opening in the lining and didn't stitch it closed so that I could access that front panel. I worked from a book of Chinese embroidery designs. I think in a former episode I mentioned that they were Japanese, but they are from Chinese textiles, and this book is in the style of an adult coloring book with white pages and just black lines to indicate the edges of the design. I really found myself drawn to a crane design in a circular motif from a woman's robe, and this crane has wings that wrap around the edges of this circular design and also a little bit of very strange looking vegetation. So I used a photocopier to enlarge the print to a size that would work for this tote bag that I have. And then I began stitching by doing the border in a stem stitch and then working to fill it in. The fabric of this bag is a very dark denim-like fabric, and I had also used fusible interfacing on the back of the fabric, which was great because I didn't need any additional backing to stabilize the embroidery motif. I think the fusible interfacing was enough of a stabilizer to make it very nice to stitch on. It was a little bit difficult to stitch through the lining of the bag, and a couple of times I did catch the lining fabric in my embroidery stitches, and I had to back out and remove that and keep going. And it was a little awkward to manipulate the embroidery hoop as I worked on this design. But for the most part, once I got the hang of it, and I just kept myself cognizant of the fact that there was a lining fabric back there that I didn't want to catch with my needle, it progressed quite nicely. My intention had been to work on this about 20 minutes a day. And the first week I really didn't get to work on it very much at all, and then worked on it for an hour or so on the weekend. Then toward the end of this week, I started to feel like I just wanted to work on it more and more, and that 20 minutes wasn't really enough for me to make any progress on the embroidery. I think this is an indication of where I stand regarding balance, because I just rejected the idea of balancing this project over the course of the month and working on it a little bit each day. So I have many strides to make in terms of balance this year. I just got very invested in the project. primarily this happened because on the way to work one morning, I was just thinking about the design and I thought, wow, you know, it's a pretty ornate design. And I wonder if I could come up with a shortcut for some element of the design. And I had been thinking about how to use couching. But then I thought about the possibility of using buttons for the feathers on the body of this crane. In the design, there's a very clear overlapping of feathers. And I thought, what if I had very small mother-of-pearl-like buttons and then I could cascade them in such a way that it would imitate the feathers. So when I got home, I looked in my grandmother's button box. Many of the buttons have been separated into different colors and different sizes, but in the bottom of the box, there are about an inch and a half of buttons. They're very dirty, and some of them are coated with grime and the metal from the box, but there were so many very small, creamy white or ivory buttons with two holes. So I took all of them that I could find and I put them in a very soapy, very hot water to rinse them off. And then I examined them and it seemed that many of them had been cut from garments, maybe garments that had worn out because there was thread through the holes. So I removed the thread and then I determined that they would look most uniform if I sewed them on back to front. So they're all backwards for the most part because the fronts have varying designs or indentations on them. And I just wanted them to look as uniform as possible. So I began with the tail end of this crane and then I started overlapping the buttons and stitching them on. I'm really pleased with the way that part came out, and then I was motivated to keep working on the design. Since the fabric of this tote bag was so dark, I was not able to really trace the design and copy it exactly. Instead, I used a white fabric pencil and I would copy one element of the design at a time and then embroider it. The aesthetic I most enjoy with embroidery is the sampler aesthetic, where a number of different stitch types and a number of textures of thread and colors are used to complete one design. I think that's playful. I also think that's great for a beginner like me because it gives me practice working on different elements. And it's a type of design that doesn't take itself too seriously. So in the course of this design, I used a variety of types of stitches, including the back stitch, seed stitch, fishbone stitch, which I think I referred to incorrectly as herringbone in a previous episode. It's a fishbone stitch. I used a chain stitch and French knots as well, and a satin stitch. So there's quite a variety of different textures and colors in this design. And although I have not yet stitched the lining of my bag closed, I think I might be finished with this crane motif. It's a pretty striking addition to this multitasker tote, and I am very much looking forward to using the bag again since it's been out of commission for quite a while I've been working on the design. The front porch. I have been making excellent progress on the thistle scarf designed by Tin Can Knits. I am almost completely done with the lace motif and will begin the column lace. And I think that the thistle design is incredibly delicate and beautiful. I love the way it's working up with this lilac or lavender colored yarn that I chose. And using the size 4 signature needles has certainly been a treat. I've been thinking also about future projects and browsing Ravelry a little bit to look at designs. And there are two that I just can't get out of my mind. Although I'm not ready to cast them on yet, I feel pretty certain that both of these will be in my future. One is Paper Cranes, a beautiful design by Lori Versace. And I will read the description. One of these is Paper Cranes, a lovely design by Lori Versace of Versace Knits. This pattern has been around since September of 2015, but I've just come across it recently. It calls for just over 1,000 yards of fingering weight yarn. And she wrote, "In honor of my daughter's wedding, I designed a shawl inspired by the 1,000 origami cranes strung throughout the wedding venue, a symbol of eternal good luck. Paper Cranes is an asymmetrical shaped shawl with a simple eyelet pattern. While the eyelet cranes appear random, in fact, my oldest daughter and artist, Amelia, worked with me to place the cranes like falling water droplets in the Japanese tradition." Doesn't that sound beautiful? The second thing that's really caught my eye is a pattern by Isolde Teague called Hidi. I believe that's the pronunciation. I think it means gift because this pattern appears in a collection of hers called Knitworthy. And in the introduction of the collection, she mentions that all of these would make very beautiful gifts. So Hidi by Isolde Teague is a snugly cabled shawl with a gently curved edging and triangular center. The edging is worked first, and then stitches for the center are picked up along one end of the long edges and decreased towards the top with a garter stitch section in the center. This shawl can be knit all in one color yarn, but I think it lends itself very well to working with different colors and even having a stripe of a contrasting color. This is knit on DK yarn on US size 7 needles. So the projects are very different from one another, yet both of them appeal to me quite a lot. So I've been thinking about yarn I have or yarn I might purchase to work on both of these, and I feel quite certain that they are both in my knitting future. Ever-expanding skill set. This week I have been cooking with jams and jellies, something that I lamented I didn't get to during the first week of February. This week, I feel that I've made up for that by making some beautiful heart-shaped cookies from a vanilla Lintz dough. This is the same dough I used for a variety of Czech Christmas cookies, but I did not fill them with jam at Christmas, and for Valentine's Day, I have. I used some blackberry jam, which was a little bit tricky to work with the cookies because some of it was quite highly textured and that made it difficult to fit between the layers of the cookies. And I also used some blackberry jelly, which the flavor isn't as good, but the consistency was better suited to the cookies. I made heart-shaped cookies, and then I also made small square-shaped cookies and used a little square punch to punch a hole in the top piece so that the beautiful jelly would sparkle through. And then I did a chocolate drizzle over these cookies as a decoration. I think they look so beautiful. It's ideal to make these cookies and decorate them with chocolate in a very deep freeze like we have now, because I feel like it's just so ideal to stick the entire tray of cookies outside on the bench and let them cool very quickly, and then they're easy to store. If they stay inside and you wait for the chocolate to cool, it can take a long time, and then it doesn't seem like it ever gets completely cool, and then it can get messy on the face of the cookie. So I think that cold weather is ideal for storage of these cookies. And then I keep them refrigerated, or I keep them outside in a very secure location where they stay cold, and let them warm up to room temperature before serving them. I also worked on a savory recipe with jam and jelly. This I'm calling triple ginger turkey meatballs. It's a take on a meatball recipe I made around the holidays, and I replaced I think I used apricot jam for those meatballs, but I replaced it with more of the blackberry jelly that I had used for the cookies. And I used it both in the meatballs and then quite a bit for the glaze. And in terms of ginger, I used freshly grated ginger, diced candied ginger, and powdered ginger. If I were to go one step further, I might use something like a ginger apricot jam for the glaze of these meatballs. Although the blackberry worked very well, and I think it lent a deeper flavor, not quite such a bright flavor, to the meatballs. I have written out my approximate measurements for this recipe and included them both on the hashtag Power Pantry thread in Ravelry and on my website this week. So if you'd like to give it a try, I certainly encourage you to do so. It's a very tasty recipe. I did not have any panko breadcrumbs on hand, and I do like to use some sort of panko or sometimes I used crushed saltines or other crackers, and I just didn't have any of that on hand. But I had some puffed millet. It's sort of like puffed rice cereal. And I used that in the meatballs, and it worked great. It almost is undetectable, but it gives the meatballs a little bit of a lightness and a fluffiness. I don't like a meatball that's just dense ground meat. I like it something in there as a little bit of a filler and to lighten it up a little bit. The puffed millet was an excellent ingredient for this dish. I think I will keep that in mind for future preparations. I served these meatballs over a bed of soba noodles and some sautéed carrots, snow peas, and onions with a sprinkle of almonds over the top. It was an excellent weeknight dinner, and the leftovers were even more flavorful than the original dish. Another dish I would like to try this month is a preparation of scallops as an entree using some jam or jelly in the sauce or glaze. I've been looking at a recipe on the Food 52 website and thinking about how to adapt it sometime this month. I also looked through my cupboards at my store of jams and jellies. One thing that I like to do is serve a jam or a jelly on a cracker with chèvre or brie or cream cheese, and then just a dollop of the jam or marmalade on the top. I think that makes a really great snack or sophisticated hors d'oeuvre. I found in my cupboard a Christmas gift that I had received, and it slipped my mind that I have bacon marmalade. I've never tasted bacon marmalade. The label says, "Eat this bacon marmalade." Should I do anything with it other than just open it and have a spoon at the ready? I would love your suggestions if you have any. Off the Shelf. This week I have continued reading The Subversive Stitch by Rosika Parker. And in chapter 4, The Domestication of Embroidery, the author takes a closer look at how the role of embroidery changed as the ideals of the roles of men and women changed. So during the Renaissance, there came to be a very bold line drawn between the role of a man and the role of a woman. And men's and women's identities were developed in stark opposition to one another. So there was very little overlap in what was seen to be appropriate for a man and what was seen to be appropriate for a woman. I think it's pretty typical to think of floral embroidery when we think of embroidery at all. And in fact, it was traditional for embroidery to be scented with flowers and stored in boxes with spikes of lavender or other perfumes when it wasn't being used. Today, flower embroidery is so closely associated with women that it is easy to overlook that in the 16th century, flowers were not considered primarily the province of women. John Gerard wrote that they admonish and stir up a man to that which is comely and honest, for flowers through their beauty, variety of color, and exquisite form, do bring to a liberal and gentlemanly mind the remembrance of honesty, comeliness, and all kinds of virtues. A fascination with plants was part of a developing interest in botany and gardening. In Embroidered Gardens, 1979, Thomasina Beck traces the association of gardening with embroidery. During the Elizabethan era, she sees this as a relationship between equals. The language of the early gardening books employed the terminology of embroidery, and embroiderers depicted the new species that were being planted in the gardens laid around the new, spacious, private houses. In 1586, when Jacques Lemoyne de Morgue published La Clef de Chaume, 98 woodcuts of animals, birds, flowers, and plants colored by hand, he intended it for the use of craft workers and their patrons, especially goldsmiths, embroiderers, and tapestry makers. And in his dedication, he wrote, "As much for the nobility as for the artisans and for all workers with the needle." This dedication is significant. The author's insistence that the book is intended for all craft workers in all media across class boundaries suggests that artistic divisions along the lines of media, sex, and class were beginning to be drawn up. Nevertheless, the fact that the woodcuts could be offered to amateurs and professionals, nobility and artisans, indicates that the categories had not yet become rigid. If we look at the place of the art of embroidery in the education of young girls of the privileged classes, we can see the effects of the fruitful interaction between embroidery and other media, as well as the setting of a pattern for the future. Richard Mulcaster's Curriculum for Girls, written in 1561, lists reading, writing, sight singing, music, and skill in needlework as necessary subjects. However, He distinguishes the education of girls in high position from that of others, and embroidery is the mark of difference. And this is a passage from his work, his curriculum. If a young maiden is to be brought up with a view to marriage, obedience to authority and similar qualities must form the best kind of training. If from necessity she has to learn how to earn her own living, some technical training must prepare her for a definite calling. If she is to adorn some high position, she must acquire suitable accomplishments, including drawing, to beautify her needlework. The place of needlework in a woman's education was to become primary by the 17th century. In the 16th century, it served two functions: endowing an education, which elevated class associations, and in making an education, which might otherwise have been deemed dangerously masculine, safely feminine.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, flowery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire, just like Linda Curtis, burn out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. Music for this episode is Sweet, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider liking the show's Facebook page, joining the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry, or leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.